Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church, and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation, and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz, business spot B-I-Z. Please use this address as we are to start a mailing list, which will then keep you informed of all the upcoming episodes, and much more. The address again is ogc@accessradio.biz. Please enjoy today's guest, who, with his wife Nada, is the director of the Balkan Institute for Faith and Culture in Skopje, Macedonia. They build bridges and make connections between communities in the former republics of Yugoslavia. Our guest has an MA in theology and in the noughties lived in England for 5 years, studying at Oxford University, the subject being early Christian studies and patristics, the result of which gave him the Langham International Partnership Scholarship, which was established by John Stott. Our guest also writes for various Macedonian newspapers and magazines. But what is Macedonia like when it comes to Christianity, especially as it is written in the New Testament? What is the Balkan Institute for Faith and Culture all about? We've maybe heard of the Balkan Wars, but what were not just one, but two wars about? All these questions, better get the answers. Gives me great pleasure to welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, all the way from Macedonia, I assume, and that is Dr. Kostas Milkov. Where are we speaking to you from, please, good sir?
Thank you, Martin. Thank you for having me on the show. It's a great pleasure and a privilege for me.
You're welcome. Thank you. So whereabouts are you at the moment, sir?
I'm in the capital, Skopje, Macedonia, in my office, in the premises of the Balkan Institute for Faith and Culture. Very central, right at the heart of the city.
Wonderful. And if people say, where's Macedonia? It's like sort of north of Greece and to right a bit. Am I right?
Yes, it's just north of Greece. And then we have to the west is Albania, to the east is Bulgaria, and to the north is Serbia and a bit of Kosovo.
Before we get to five questions, I'd love to know, because it's a country I haven't been to. So what's Macedonia like?
Well, it is a mountainous country, first of all. Every settlement, every city, town, village will be more or less surrounded by mountains. Traditionally, now it is less and less so, but traditionally it's an agricultural country where we have produced a lot of early vegetables especially, and other crops, very fertile as well. Long history, obviously, in this context, in this part of the world. And also Macedonians are warm, welcoming people that enjoy company. They really enjoy company. They value the extended family as well, and also people who would always be very hospitable to strangers.
Excellent. Well, it sounds as if I should be there straight away. It ticks all my boxes.
Yeah, you should indeed. Among other things, we also have perhaps the oldest lake in Europe, around 2 million years old, and very deep, around 385 meters deep, pristine, clean, beautiful. It's called Lake Ohrid, after the city Ohrid, and it is known for that it has 365 churches around the lake, one church for every day of the year.
Yeah.
A great tourist place.
Well, I'm there. Right, well, no doubt we'll hear more about Macedonia and the part it plays within the Balkans. But first, let's go to the five important, or maybe not so important, questions. Get a bigger idea of yourself, Kostas, if that's okay. Question number one. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask him questions, who would it be, good sir?
That would be, surprise, surprise, Alexander the Great, or as he's known, Alexander of Macedon.
Well, you're the first person, I'm going to have to say, a round of applause. In all my years of doing this, I don't think I've ever had him. So this is going to be great. Let's see how many times you mention things that I know about Macedonia. About Alexander the Great. And a knot comes to mind. So tell me more, please.
Why I have chosen him now? You might be again now doubly surprised. First that I have mentioned him at all, and now why is the reason behind? Because I'm not impressed by the person at all, by him as a historical person. You know, someone who in 10 years between ascending on the throne at 23 and die at 33, all he did was to wage invading wars. If you ask me, I would much more actually identify myself with Van Gogh, who between 27th and 37th year of 10 years of painting, he created much greater legacy. But now back to the reasons why I have chosen Alexander the Great, Alexander of Macedon, because The question I would have asked him if I were able to summon him from wherever he is and talk to him in person would say, would ask him, tell me, are you Greek or Macedonian? That would be the question I'm going to ask him. I don't think he will give me an answer, actually. And that will be the answer, and explain why. Because the question to him will be quite incomprehensible. Because today, the claim of various Balkan nations, all of them, but most notably Greeks and Macedonians, is that the ancients who lived in the same territory thought about themselves, including Alexander the Great or Alexander of Macedon, in terms of modern nation state that has actually emerged in the late 18th century. And much of our pain, much of our struggles, much of the conflicts and much of the wounds and the pain we have experienced collectively and as a region actually goes back to such thinking. And I believe if I ask him this question, he will look at me very puzzled. He would not know what to say. And I think that will be a resounding answer to all of us.
So to get us into context then, where was Alexander the Great? I'm assuming that wasn't his surname, you know, Mrs. the Great. Where was he from originally then?
He was born in a city now called Pella, which is in the northern part of Greece, which is also geographically part of Macedonia.
But if we go back in time and meet him 2,000, 4,000 years ago, however long it was, where would he say he was from?
I'm sure he would say geographically, he would say Macedonia, definitely, I would say. But he would not mean any of those things. And this is precisely, I really would not like to go into the details of trying to find any sort of identity of such a person, because we are talking about anachronism.
Yes.
And the only, again, going back to that, the only reason why I mentioned him is because we have made, in a way, a hero as if should be an aspiring figure to many of us, when basically what I think is really that he is a historical person, and in many ways historically he should be great in any stretch of imagination. He is great, but I believe most of the time for the wrong reasons.
Well, that's going to be a fascinating time. What language would he speak to you, do you think, his natural language?
Well, there is a way of people trying to say, and there was some vernacular, local vernacular that the local people were speaking, but this is very also disputed. There are some glosses that come from ancient Macedonian vernacular language that are not deciphered, that we cannot really understand exactly what they were saying. But all through, I believe the lingua franca, the language he would have used, was definitely the Hellenic language, the ancient Greek language.
And can you speak any of that?
I have studied the classical Greek for my own purposes to read and that, but I don't speak more than Greek language.
You should get on like a house on fire, really, if we could arrange it. That's a great answer, thank you. And ask him about whether it's true that didn't he get a knot or something in a piece of rope and he cut it in half or something?
Well, this is sort of the Gordian's knot. He cut it because the legend was that whoever unties it, he will conquer the world and etc. And he, instead of doing that, he just pulled the sword and just cut the rope.
It's a bit like Indiana Jones, isn't it, in the first film, where you got the bloke coming out of the crowd with his whip and everything else, and Indiana just shoots him instead. Yeah.
Yes, I do remember that. Actually, I've seen that sequence. It's really humorous, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. I saw it at the cinema when it came out. That's how old I am, and it's one of the very rare events when the whole cinema applauded because they it was totally expected. Great answer, thank you, Alexander the Great. Question two: who is your favorite biblical character, or favorite biblical story, or favorite parable, please, sir?
Yes, that would be Joseph.
Which one?
Joseph, the son of Jacob.
Ah.
Sorry, yes, of course, I should have qualified that.
Yeah, sorry, I just want to show off that I do know there's more than one Joseph.
yes, suddenly I just thought, Joseph. And I suspect that the choice of Joseph would be for all the popular choices, and he would be popular choice, I believe, for obvious reasons. He was faithful to God through thick and thin. But I think that faithfulness, not only resisting temptation and sticking to God's principles, I think it's faithfulness that never lost view of responsibility. His take on responsibility to the community, to me, is a stellar example of what we mean to be faithful to God.
Yes.
Faithful to God means, in a context of community, being responsible to that community. And jumping thousands and upon thousands of years, connecting them, I would say, I would quote what I mean by this. Another figure from the 20th century, his name is Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Oh, very good.
And his view on responsibility, and I'm going to quote him, because he says, to talk of going down fighting like heroes in the face of certain defeat is not really heroic at all, but merely a refusal to face the future. And now is the main point he makes. The ultimate question for a responsible man to ask is not how he is to extricate himself heroically from the affair, but how the coming generation is going to live. So it's not only from this question, but also with responsibility towards history, that fruitful solutions can come, even if for the time being they are very humiliating. We know how Bonhoeffer ended his life, and we know how Joseph ended his life. And why I also chose this quotation, because the end of the lives of these two people is diametrically opposite. But I believe both of them witness with the same faithfulness to God, being responsible to the community and to the context in which they were put and in which they lived.
Great answer. Anyone that mentions Dietrich Bonhoeffer is all right by me. Thank you.
Why I believe this is so important is that both Joseph and Dietrich Bonhoeffer did many of those things without trying to be any accolades, to receive any accolades.
Yes.
They tried not to do any PR around it at all. But at the same time, they did call to also call people to responsibility and also call people to be accountable for what they have done and how they have done it. So I believe it's a complete picture about what we perhaps in the 21st century right now lack, because it is so much more about the celebrity culture, about how people see you and not who you are.
Mm.
And I believe that both Joseph and Dietrich Bonhoeffer are giving us a stellar example of what it means to be responsible to the community, by actually the foundation of that being faithful to God.
Lovely. Thank you. Cut out just a little bit there, but it's amazing that I can speak to you live from Skopje, and I'm over here in Northern Ireland, and how many seas and lands in between, and we can still talk to each other. It's brilliant. Question three. This is going to be interesting. If you are Prime Minister of the UK, or you can be President of the USA, or the leader of Macedonia, and could change any law or impose a new law, first of all, what would you want to be? And then question two, what would it be?
Well, regardless, let's say if I can be not in the UK, but perhaps let's call it even maybe even a bigger country for the purposes of what I think we should do.
Okay, this would be controversial. President of the European Union, then. There you go.
Actually, that perhaps, I hope this will be helpful. I don't know whether they have so much power, but for what I would like to do, and it's to be it's to ban any single use plastics and use of petrol-based synthetic fabric for clothing. I will put an ubiquitous, complete, total, and eternal ban on single-use plastics. You know what, Martin? Recent research shows that 56 companies of the world are the source of more than 50% of all the plastic pollution in the world. Then 5 companies in the world, out of those 56, are responsible for 24%. Of that pollution. And one, let's say, okay, I will not name it, but one that's research, it says, one of them is responsible for 11% of the total pollution.
Wow.
I do believe that that we should go after those who are causing the problem. Usually it is the common person that usually we put all the pressure on to do things for supposedly to care for the planet, when we are coming down to actually 56 entities that should be controlled in a better way. And I believe if that happens, perhaps we will be able to reduce such pollution in a very, very radical way. I can understand many other things that are polluting the world, because they are at the same time somehow contributing to whatever, let's say, I will not go into the details, but with plastics, I genuinely believe that single-use plastics is not contributing to anything, even to the quality of life as such. And also with single use, we are not contributing to anything, and especially clothing. We have perfectly good natural fabrics to choose from, and there's plenty of it. Why do we use that I think it's simply profit. That's it.
I mentioned the word profit. Yeah, as if that comes into play, Costa, if that comes into play. That's a very interesting point you make. And I would actually take it a bit further that if you are caught throwing plastic, let's say, into the sea, then at the very least, you're given a very stern talking to.
Yes, I agree.
I can't understand why people do that. But yes, very, very good. Thank you so much indeed. Good luck with getting that through, by the way, especially if you become the EU president. And I'll look forward to meeting you as an EU president years to come. Thank you.
You hold me accountable.
I'll say, do you remember, Costa, what you said? What are you doing about it? I'll be standing up on the stage. I demand action and all that. Question four, outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out to date, please, Costa?
I would say it's not only one day. It has been for almost 3.5 years now. Every morning, every day of those 3.5 years, it's walking my dog.
Oh, really?
Every morning. Oh, yes. I wake up at 5:30 in the morning. I have a beautiful big, it's called Karaman. Karaman is the breed. It's a Macedonian shepherd dog. His name is Amos, after the prophet.
Oh, you say Amos. We say Amos, but you say Amos.
Amos, yes. And I walk him every morning. We live in a place which is just kind of, as I said, Macedonia, surrounded by mountains. It's very mountainous where we. So I take him for walks. Nice views of mountain peaks and etc. and valleys. It is definitely the favorite thing outside of doing something with my family. That is definitely the most favorite moment of the day for me.
That's brilliant. So for those that are dog lovers then, what is a Macedonian Shepherd dog like, please?
The Macedonian Shepherd dog belongs to the breed of Molosses. These are like rather bulky, big dogs. Yeah, he has, in pounds, I believe he will be around 110 pounds approximately. 55 kilos or something like that, 56 kilos.
What, like a Bernese mountain dog, that sort of thing?
Yeah, Bernese, a bit slightly larger perhaps, a little bit.
Wow.
And yes, and they're mostly black. It's allowed to have a little bit of white on the front, a bit on the paws. They're very friendly with people. They're very, very friendly. They're safe around children. And they're really bred for protection of livestock as such. It's also very good to have them around because they're big, enormous dogs, but they're, as I said, very safe around people.
And obviously cheap to run as well. Hardly any food is needed.
Any food, no. You can look from whatever perspective you can look at. Actually, I had this conversation with my mother, and we were discussing the expenses and how much, what it costs and etc. Yeah. And I always said, but mom, you see, this dog has such a good psychosomatic effect on me that he basically saves me from going to the hospital. So it's much cheaper to have him around.
Ah, yeah, of course. Yes, that's a great answer. Well, this turning the tables a bit then, the final question, Costa, what's been your most embarrassing moment to date, please?
Well, I was maybe 6 or 7 years old. I didn't live in this village, but this is where my grandmother comes from. And I love that place. It's again in a valley next to a beautiful mountain and a waterfall. And my favorite pastime was just to roam the mountain and run around. And one of the illegitimate activities we as children did was to actually go to a pool, which was not meant for swimming. It was meant for watering the fields.
Oh, yeah.
It was mountain cold water, maybe 13, 14 degrees Celsius, very cold. We were all small children, unsupervised, and it was strictly forbidden to go in there. And in those years, in the mid-70s or so, in the village, the swimming trunks were not something popular. So we all went there in our underwear or so. And then the principal of the elementary school passed by us as we were swimming in that improvised pool. And as a punishment, he took the clothes of every one of us.
No.
So we had to walk back home in our underwear and to face the consequences, every one of us back to see our parents and grandparents. And I was single-handedly chosen by peer pressured by the rest of the people because I was the only one who lived in the city and didn't go to this school. So they said, I am the only person that should be nominated to go and ask from the principal back the clothes. So I had to go back and beg for our clothes back from him. To this very day, it's like almost 50 years ago, and I'm still very embarrassed by the experience.
Yeah. Well, what did you say and what did the bloke say in return?
I really can't remember verbatim what I've said and what happened, but I just remember the scene. I went there, he was, it wasn't even his office, he was somewhere with his car. I went there and I said, please, can I have our clothes back? Everybody laughed that were around him. He opened the trunk, gave me the clothes, and something to the effect of, I reprimand you, don't you dare to do this again. This was pretty much how I grew up. It takes a village to raise a child. It was a very communal thing. And my parents never thought of him doing any wrong by doing that, because he was the responsible adult to do something about that was potentially very dangerous to our health and our lives.
That's a really good point you've just made there. You know, the village is responsible for the upbringing of the child.
Yeah.
Would that happen today, do you think?
No. I don't think so. They would not dare, honestly. Not even a village anymore. No. It's a different world we live in, don't we?
Can you imagine the health and safety officers coming along for a start?
Yeah, everything. Yes.
Wow. Yes. And then the social side of it as well. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. That's a great story. Thank you. Well, you said at the beginning a little bit of what Macedonia was or is like, should I say, as far as the geography and the geology is concerned. But where is it spiritually these days? Bearing in mind, it's mentioned in the Bible. So, you know, what's it like?
It prides itself with almost 2,000 years of Christianity ever since Apostle Paul came in this region. And we have several cities that are right now like archaeological excavation sites. So we have basically early church, both synagogues and basilicas go back to the 4th, 5th century, very, very early stages that shows... even if before as Christianity was persecuted and there were no like a visible extant things that you can see from earlier stages, when you see how big, let's say, a cathedral church was in the 5th and the 6th century, it shows you how thriving and how large, big the Christianity group was. And then being under the context of the Eastern Roman Empire, ever since 336, when Constantine built Constantinople, and Constantinople started taking more and more importance in the Roman Empire, eventually to the effect of becoming actually the most important city for many years in the Eastern Roman Empire. This region has developed within the context of the Christian confession of Eastern Orthodoxy. So most of the people in Macedonia, 66% of the people will call themselves will claim they're Eastern Orthodox, and 33% of the people will be nominally, also traditionally Muslims, and the rest of the, whatever they are, Roman Catholics, Protestants, other religions, and atheists would be around 1% of the total population as such.
Right.
We are very much open to as a Balkan Institute of Faith and Culture, we are very much open to cooperation with all Christian communities in Macedonia. And we are basically trying to be in good relationship with especially the groups that are trying to bring some sort of a revival within. And there are several such initiatives within the Eastern Orthodox Church as well, I'm glad to say. Some of these people are very dear friends of ours that are basically trying to actually revive and explain to people that Christian faith is not only about tradition. It's not only about going there to Easter and Christmas or for funerals or for weddings, but it should be a thriving liturgical and Eucharistic life as such. I would say that in many ways, although we used to be a communist country or socialist country, to say the least, and religion was not very much encouraged, still it is a nominally very, very religious place. I think more than 85% of the people would still call themselves religious, that they believe in God. And the vast majority of them would still identify, at least culturally, with either Eastern Orthodoxy or Islam or some other Christian faith. So that is where we stand at the moment. And let's call it, if I can call it, an active, practicing Christian presence in the country altogether is perhaps not more than 5 or 6% of the people that are going regularly to church.
Which I think is higher than what it is in England currently.
It is definitely higher than England. I think England is 2.5-3%, I believe, or something like that.
I think that's what I heard, Wow. You mentioned the word Balkan. I've mentioned the word Balkan. I always like to know where these words come from. Where does the word Balkan come from? I think you can tell us more about the wars I alluded to at the beginning, please.
The word Balkan is, again, it there could be several hypotheses, but I will not go into all of these. So that if people search, they should know that I am actually going for one of what I think is the most common. It comes from when the Ottoman Empire took over this territory ever since really the late 14th century.
Mm-hmm.
In 1371, there was a very decisive battle that they won, the Ottoman Empire. And ever since then, they occupied this territory and they called it Balkan, which basically means a combination of the land of hills is one of the interpretations. The other interpretation is that it's a land of blood and honey.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Hills, as in the mountainous area that you talk about,
yes,
as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Got you. How many countries then actually make up what you would consider to be the Balkan territories?
Also, this is a bit controversial. Again, it depends who do you ask. So geographically, let me try to be on the safe side of things. Geographically, I believe that the Balkans actually reaches out as far in Europe, in European territory, as far as Vienna.
Oh, really?
Austria.
Okay.
That is how far it goes. But I believe culturally, people that would be comfortable to say that we are part of the Balkan would be definitely from Turkey onwards, Bulgaria, Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, even Bosnia and Herzegovina, Montenegro, Albania, all of those countries will perhaps be very okay, they'll be fine with being called both geographically and culturally Balkan. But the countries that are west of Danube, let's say, yes, especially like Croatia and onwards and Slovenia, they would have some issues about calling them Balkans. Again, not for the geographical term, as much as perhaps culturally. There is actually one theorist. Her name is of Bulgarian origin. She lives in France, I believe. Her name is Maria Todorova, and she wrote actually a book called Imagining the Balkans, in which she is challenging this kind of a stereotype about the Balkans and the Balkanization, the word Balkanization, etc. Actually, I've read recently, I'm writing an article on nationalism, mm-hmm, in the region, in the Balkans, right now, for one magazine. And in my studies, in my research, I have actually come across a very interesting kind of research and statistics saying that the Balkans historically, in the last 100 years, have seen less violence than much of the Western, of the European and Western world as such, if you put them cumulatively.
Wow.
It's very interesting to see. It's like, oh, sometimes we are just stereotypical about some things. And the other side, we are naturally, actually the Balkans might come across as a place where many people don't know how to live together. But usually is the problem is that, you know how, Martin, you come from also from background of media and news, you know how very often they say bad news is a good news for the media, that is the news that actually sells or people can hear. This is the unfortunate, like one bad news would trump a 99 other good news, you know. And I do believe actually the Balkans can in many ways, historically and traditionally, apart from some outbursts of serious violence and etc., can actually show the way of how a real life together of people with different ethnicities, different religions and backgrounds and worldviews can actually be good neighbors to each other.
Let's talk about the good things in a minute, because obviously I'd love to know more about your fantastic organization of which you're the director of.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got the word Balkan in your title, so we can't, mm-hmm, we can't go, mm-hmm, away from it.
Yes.
The Balkan Wars, not one, but two. Tell me more, please.
Yes. The Balkan Wars were actually waged over the territory of Macedonia. That was it. Again, it is very important to make the distinction between what is now Republic of Macedonia and what is the geographical territory of Macedonia.
Yes.
And the geographical territory of Macedonia was the last territory that the Ottoman Empire still controlled as an inherent unified part of the empire as such. Mm-hmm. The Balkan Wars were the beginning of the total, the full disintegration of the Ottoman Empire that basically led to the 22-23 civil wars within Turkey and eventually emerging with Ataturk, Kemal Mustafa, who was, by the way, born in Macedonia, in this territory.
Was he?
The father of the Turks. Yes, he was born here.
Wow.
And he formed, you know, what we know modern Turkey. So the two Balkan Wars were actually wars over the territory of Macedonia and the people who live in it, because the other countries, like by that time Greece, Bulgaria, and Serbia, first joined forces to fight against the Ottoman Empire in order to liberate, as if it were, the territory of Macedonia. And then immediately after this was over, they started a war between each other in order to control parts of Macedonia and its population.
And what years are we talking about for this?
1912, 1913. Yeah.
Warming up very nicely for a certain First World War.
Yeah, and then that led into the conflict of the First World War, which again was sparked in Sarajevo, 1914.
And this is the thing. Most people, I would think, who know a little bit of history would say, ah, oh, yes, Archduke Ferdinand, he was assassinated in Sarajevo, as you say.
Yes, yes.
But most people would not be aware that it was due to a Balkan, a war going on around it at the time.
Yes, and Bosnia was in a way suffering a similar fate like the territory of Macedonia, because it had different populations living there. A vast majority of Muslims live and still live there, then Croats, who are traditionally Roman Catholics, and then Serbs that are traditionally Eastern Orthodox. And all of them thought this should be our country. You know, it belongs traditionally to us, whether Croats, Serbs, or Bosniaks, as they're known now. So the reason why the assassination happened was basically that Bosnia was given to the Austro-Hungary to control after the withdrawal of the Ottomans from there. And Macedonia comes a bit later in the late 19th century. This is in the early 20th century that is happening, but we are actually suffering very, very similar fates to this very day.
The Ottoman Empire out of Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, which is in Turkey, for those that are thinking, oh, I've heard of this place.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is then, what language did they speak in Macedonia at the time, and what do they speak now?
It was really a Slavic language. I would say that in the territory of Macedonia, the vast majority of the people spoke the language that you can hear me now. Of course, language is a living matter. In 100 years, it has evolved in various ways. But most of the people would have spoken a dialect, at least a dialect of what I am speaking right now. So it's a Slavic language for which the brothers Cyril and Methodius in the 9th century have invented first the Glagolic and then later the Cyrillic alphabet for the Christianization of the Slavs.
Well, the language you speak right now sounds remarkably like English, unless you are speaking a native tongue and I've got the gift of translation.
Maybe I should try Macedonian and then see whether you really have the gift of tongues.
Try it then. Go for it.
Martin, mnogo mi je milo što se zapoznavme.
Oh, dzień dobry. There you go.
What I said, Martin, I'm so glad we've met.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you. Yes, I didn't have a clue. And that's Macedonian. That's what it's called.
Yes.
And how much similar is that to Greek?
No similarities. Greek is an entirely different language. So this is similar to Bulgarian, Serbian, Croatian, even, you know, other Slavic languages.
And Bosnia, 100-odd years ago, if you had met somebody from Bosnia, they would understand you.
It depends what region you came from and, mm-hmm. and et cetera. But in general, I do believe there was, because the language that is used in the Orthodox Church, the traditional one, it's called the Old Slavonic language, is the common ground for all of the Slavic languages, basically. And I do believe that even then, with some difficulties, people maybe not the finesse, not the depth of whatever it was communicated, or maybe if you wanted to read a very, very elaborate book, people might have, if they could read, they would have difficulties understanding. But the common communication of the daily life, this is now kind of a bit random, but I would say it's 70% of the content will be understood.
I've got you. So that's the first war in the 1912-1913, looking at trying to get out the Ottoman Empire.
Yes.
Which we know did eventually succeed, but obviously it brought in World War One.
Yeah.
Second Balkan War. Tell me more about that, please.
The reason for the Second Balkan War was because the three countries, Greece, Bulgaria, and Serbia, all of them wanted to claim the territory of Macedonia. And the easiest way to do that was basically to introduce your own liturgical language, whether Greek, whether Bulgarian or Serbian, whichever language people spoke in the church, they should have been considered that nation.
Right.
The main reason why they were doing this is it was because people did not actually have, did not have such a developed sense about who they were in terms of nationally, like what we would imagine people feel and talk about today. I believe it's a bit anachronistic to speak and to say that people who lived in the 19th century and were beginning the development of whatever independent countries they eventually ended to be, they would have had a very exact, very same feeling about what nation is, because they didn't understand what nation state meant. And nation state, as you would well know, actually was a result of the Enlightenment, a result of the French Revolution, a result of such developments, you know, post-Reformation development. Again, in one of this research that I'm doing on for the article I'm writing on nationalism, one article I have consulted while I was writing this, it's a Turkish author actually who is studying the Ottoman Empire and what has happened to the Ottoman Empire between late 19th century and the First World War, says basically because people didn't have such a strong feeling of what nation supposedly they belonged to, the only outlet that the elite was able to use in order to rally people around was actually violence.
Yes.
Rather than anything else. And then on this, as violence was exploding and people were turned against each other in villages and other places around the territory, this is how supposedly this idea about who we are as a nation, etc., started emerging. And this is also part of the struggles that we are, especially as Macedonians have, because everybody is telling us from the neighboring countries that we are somehow an artificial nation, that we are somehow a nation that was invented more recently, and etc., etc. And I do believe that, of course, every nation is based on a myth. And I do believe that much of what has happened is what you see now, especially in the context of what is now the Republic of Macedonia, is basically resolved because Macedonia was the last one to still be under the control of the Ottoman Empire. And other countries were already formed. They were forming themselves as either Greece or Bulgaria or Serbia. And of course, the easiest way for them to claim the territory was to claim that these people who live on this territory were either Greeks, Bulgarians, or Serbs as such.
Which is what Hitler did, of course, when he went in to annex the Sudetenland.
Of course, yes, yes.
So some things never change. What's interesting as well is that we've got the first war, the Balkan War, 1912-1913.
Yes.
We've got the second Balkan War of the 1990s. But what we're also missing out is Yugoslavia.
Yes.
Very quickly, and I'm doing quickly because I think we can then move on to the most important bit, what you're doing now. But in 30 seconds or so, please summarize what Yugoslavia was and is, please.
Well, Yugoslavia was a federation of six republics and also two so-called kind of regions that were sort of independent, both Kosovo and Vojvodina. It was formed within the same borders of what used to be Yugoslavia after 1918, which was a country called Yugoslavia, or the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes at the beginning, so that Macedonians and many other Bosniaks and other nations were not recognized. Then the Second World War, the war there actually enabled few of these nations, as they were joining the fight against the Nazis, they wanted to be defined. That includes the Macedonian people. And 1944-1945, the Yugoslavia, the Socialist Republic of Yugoslavia was formed. And these six republics came to live together. But much of the history among some of these countries, especially between the Serbs and the Croats mostly, and especially within the context of Bosnia and Herzegovina, also had a long history of animosity and huge violence, very, very bad violence. And that actually led into the disintegration of Yugoslavia 10 years after the death of its founder, Josip Broz Tito. And in that particular context, people started going back again to this kind of historic revisionism and supposed golden age, where our nation has always been the best of all the nations, and we have always been the victims, and the others were the perpetrators. And this kind of discourse came on the fore. Nationalism was high and rised, and eventually the very, very bloody conflict started in the 90s.
It doesn't seem like it was like 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So modern day Macedonia and Bosnia and all the other previous states that you've mentioned, what's it like with them at the moment, politically wise, these days?
Bosnia is in a very difficult position, very, very difficult position, because they are basically a federation of three nations, the Croats, the Bosniaks and the Serbs. And they're almost geographically divided between, you know, the something which is called Republika Srpska and the rest of the territory of Bosnia and Herzegovina as total. They're really not in good relationship, especially Republika Srpska versus the rest of the population that lives in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And that is really creating a lot of ongoing conflict, and that is far from resolved, I would say. In Macedonia, we just had the elections yesterday.
Oh, wow.
And also, we are a multinational, multi-religious country. As I said, 66% of the people that are Orthodox and 33% of the people are Muslims. So traditionally, we have Muslims here. The vast majority of people who are Orthodox are Macedonian, ethnic Macedonians, but also some Serbs and other people who live in the country. The Muslim population is mainly made from the largest ethnic group after the Macedonians is the Albanians, then the Turks, and a lot of Roma people that are also they're also Muslims. So we are multinational, multicultural, and many languages are used in it. And we are still learning. Basically, to be honest, we did learn, and we actually can be, as I said, an example of how we could live together as people with different ethnic backgrounds and languages. We can be an example of all of that. But due to, I believe, very many political opportunisms in the political elite, they have used some of the most base, vile kind of sensibilities in the people, so that they have basically rallied us against each other. So the country currently is very divided. It's very, very divided. I also think that part of that is because we have not really resolved things that have happened in the past.
Yes. Very quickly then, who won the election yesterday?
Well, it was something which is called the Conservative Party. Uh-huh. The coalition of the main leading Conservative Party and coalition of leading parties, they actually won by a landslide. And also we had double elections. The other one was the presidential elections. It happened due to political circumstances in the last several years. And also the candidate that was supported, she is not a part of that party, but supported by this Conservative Party, she won. And one, let's say, a very special, let's say, a positive thing out of this is she will be the very first woman president of the country.
Wow. Yeah. Which leads on, actually, from politics. You have started up the Balkan Institute for Faith and Culture. And the question is, having you explain so brilliantly what's going on in all those states, why? Why? So tell me more, please.
Oh, it's very simple. I believe this is my call. I come from Macedonia, was born and raised here, but I studied in Croatia for 4 years and almost 5 years. That's where I met my wife. She's Croatian by birth. Ah. We are married for almost 33 years. And many of those years we have spent in Macedonia. So she also came to also love this country dearly and commit herself to everybody who lives here. So we believe God has really called us to be here, to be present in this country, love mm-hmm. this country with all its background, beauty, and wonderful, but also not so wonderful and sometimes really bad aspects of it. In 2005, we went to Oxford for me to do my doctoral studies in early church studies. And my wife finished her Master's of Arts in International Publishing at Oxford Brookes University.
Ah.
And we returned back to Macedonia. An inspiration for all of that was John Stott, whom I met back in 1994. And he really inspired me to pursue theology, so that when I was ready in 2004, 10 years later, he was very instrumental for me actually receiving the Langham scholarship. In 2009, 2010, We returned back to Macedonia to reestablish ourselves back within the context. And then in 2011, we founded the Balkan Institute of Faith and Culture, which is basically an entity with a vision to help Christian communities of all backgrounds and confessions to understand contemporary culture and have an impact that is both culturally relevant and biblically faithful. What is very important in what we do is that to appreciate people for who they are. So we really want to appreciate all the people with whom we encounter, honor the image of God in them, and to use one example of Justin Martyr from the mid-second century, a thinker and Christian, to say that every single person is created in the image of God, but also has the logos of God who gives life, has given us to be also, to have the life in us, which he has one logos, has become many logi, or the word of God has become many of us as we are created. And in this context, we want to enter the reality of the inaugurated kingdom of God. We honor every single person for who they are. We want to be their friends because they are who they are. Mm-hmm. And then on the basis of that, allow them to express themselves in the best possible way. And we clearly and transparently tell them that we as Christians then, we honor and praise God for what this person can do, whether they're all authors, writers, whether they're artists, whether they're musicians, whether they're politicians, whether they're, you know, a scientist or whatever. So that is what we are trying to do. And one of the programs we have established ever since we returned in 2011 is something which is called the Oxford Connections. Mm-hmm. Dear friends from Oxford, in 10 years that has happened, Oxford Connections in Macedonia, we have brought an 8 tenured professors have come to the program to contribute to the academic life of Macedonia, whether in the academy, the universities, engagement with especially the cabinet of the president, whoever was incumbent president at the mm-hmm. times. So this was one of the main ways of how we actually made this bridge between Christian faith and our culture at WIDE.
Wow. Well, I'm really pleased we spent quite a bit of time talking about, albeit briefly, the history of these states that make up the Balkan area, because now we get a better understanding. But it must be an absolute nightmare whilst you're trying to promote peace through arts and music and everything else. It must be an absolute nightmare. So what difficulties have you faced as a Christian trying to do this, to promote love from God in these other countries?
Well, I would say that the difficulties that we would face is usually, sometimes it's actually a bit of a bias, that's a double bias, because the world we live in is mostly traditionally Eastern Orthodox. Mm-hmm. So if you don't belong to the Orthodox Church, sometimes people are a bit biased about who you are and why would you do what you do, etc.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the academia is by and large also coming out of a post-communist background and also trying to take part into the wider phenomenon of what is happening in academia today in the 21st century and the increasing secularism and even, I would say, atheism as such. So this has always been the challenge. But God has granted us the grace of us being, if I can sum up the essence of the Balkan Institute of Faith and Culture, it will be an honest broker in society mm-hmm. in which people feel safe to be and they feel that they can actually express themselves in a context which is openly Christian without any compromise, clearly communicating what we believe the gospel and what the good news about Jesus Christ is all about. But our vision with the BIFC, as the acronym has it, is to actually present the best theory and the best practice from Christian legacy to act as an honest broker in modern society for the flourishing of that society, so that we engage in the world of arts, in the world of mm-hmm. literature, in the world of statecraft, sciences. And the overall purpose is to mediate a Christian message and presence in the public square, which is both transparent and appealing, among other things. Includes writing and publishing work, literary cafe, and also art gallery. So that is, you know, in essence, what the Balkan Institute for Faith and Culture is all about.
So if I lived in one of the Balkan countries then, how and where would I come across you?
Here in Skopje, we have our premises, and the Balkan Institute for Faith and Culture is in a close proximity in relation with another entity, which is an independent entity, We founded them both for different purposes, but they work very well together. And that is also the so-called the institution called Metanoia, the Greek word for repentance, really. Mm-hmm. And that is a literary cafe, publishing house, and an art gallery, 3-in-1. And the Balkanist for Faith and Culture. So that is in a building, very central in the city, right in the main square of Skopje. People can find us. And we are frequented also by a variety of guests, especially because the cafe is open for all public to come in.
So this institute is great. What about, though, if you live in a different country altogether? What's your presence in other countries?
We are situated in Macedonia. We are called the Balkanist of Faith and Culture. And I am also as a theologian and as a person that is a public, let's say, public intellectual, I'm invited by various entities around Europe, mostly mm-hmm. the Balkans and even the world, to engage, especially in the academia. Like student organizations are inviting me to speak on various topics about the Christian faith. So that is what we do. And that is how we are mostly present in former Yugoslavia, the Balkans, and even further through the world. I would say, unfortunately, until the beginning of the war in Ukraine in 2022, until that year, Ukraine happened to be, for one reason or another, I don't know especially why, but maybe because majority of people there are Eastern Orthodox, and I have an expertise on that background as a Protestant.
Yeah, yeah.
They have invited me, and I have such a wonderful memories. I do, and I still keep in touch with many dear friends from the Christian community there, from the student movement in called SSH in Ukraine. I have traveled to Kharkiv, Kiev, Odessa, and Lviv, and visited like numerous dozens and dozens of universities in which I did speak on a given topic that was related between Christian faith, theology, and and culture, art, literature, etc. So this is the way how we are, if I may say, would expand our presence. But our focus is really on Macedonia because we believe we have been called here, mm-hmm. and we want to be as much as possible present in this particular context and use this kind of, I would call it, grace of God in order to not only engage with culture, but really contribute to culture. Because what both my wife Nada and I believe is that when you encounter people, regardless where they come from, regardless where their walk of faith happened to be at that moment, as we are witnessing for Christ to them, the moment we allow them in a genuine way to express themselves, like artists, to take, for example, the most tangible and the most recent effect, because ever since 2019, we do have the art gallery and we have hosted 16 exhibitions to which we have published catalogs and to which I have always written the review of the exhibition as such.
Yes.
And they have all been published in a magazine in Macedonia. So we really believe what is happening when we do that. We are actually, it is called Kingdom of God happens. We believe this is exactly what the Kingdom of God is all about. And it's not about asking people, we want to witness to people about Christ and we want people to fall in love with Christ. And we want Christ to shape their lives as much as he can shape ours. And we hope we can only be, to a certain extent, a faithful example, not a perfect one, not even a decent one at certain points, but a faithful example of what Christ wants from us. But at the same time, we want these people to realize that we rejoice to them specifically for who they are and what they do and how they do it. And we rejoice to their gifts. And we want to enhance the ways how they communicate, a part of how they express themselves about life, about arts, about even meaning of life, and etc. And this is one of the main visions and the main driving engines that actually makes us want to come to work every morning to our offices, to the place in which we organize various events, whether it is publication of books, whether it is, as I said, art exhibitions, whether it is public talks on Christianity or on something wider. Among other things, I'm also an author. I have written 5 books, of which one is a novel for children, 2 are books, a collection of poetry, and two of them are short stories.
What you're doing here then basically is great, because you've got a coffee shop, and when people come into the coffee shop, there's all the art and there's all the literature for them to start to get involved.
Yes.
And as we know full well, mm-hmm. but most governments refuse to talk about it, it's just how important the art industry is in breaking down barriers. And that is what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently then, if you get a Muslim from Macedonia coming in, what does he or she think of what's going on there, what you're trying to do?
We are very transparent. So we don't want people to feel that they've been deceived in any by any stretch of imagination when they enter. And also the cafe is really open to public.
Yeah, yeah.
As it is the gallery and also the bookstore, because the bookstore sends the vast majority of the books are Christian background or author's book written by Christians as such. However, we are very frank and open on what basis this premises and this entity operates and works. But as I said, when we talk about the cafe as such, when we talk about what we're trying to actually do, we are trying basically to say that we need to create a place for refreshing of the whole person, regardless mm-hmm. who these people are, Muslims or not. Interesting enough, many of them come from such background. They've chosen either their Turkish or Albanian and Muslim background and etc. And we are very open and frank with them of who we are and what we do. And we invite them to a variety of events if they want, if they choose to come. And they keep choosing to come. Many of them are very excited. Many of them actually say that they have studied for every single exam for their university studies in our cafe. Most recently, a couple
wow.
that is from Serbia, Albanian girl from Serbia and a boy that they're a couple now from Kosovo, Pristina. Now they're working and studying in the design and fashion industry in Milan. So they just recently visited us and they came and they said that they're still looking for a metanoia place in Milan.
Wow.
It affected them in such a wonderful and deep way. And I want to say that much of that also, it's like my wife and I are doing all of these things, but I must say that what happens in metanoia and the way how these things is kind of vibrant about inviting people is really my wife, Nada. She's got the gift of being welcoming, of being very perceptive about the look and the aesthetic of the place, but also with what the place resonates.
Yes.
And what she really wants to do is like to say that metanoia is a place for the refreshment of the whole person. And one of her favorite authors, whom we also published in Macedonian through Metanoia, is Henry Nouwen. And then this is exactly what my wife, Nada, wants, and I together want the place Metanoia to be. And we use his statement about hospitality. Hospitality that creates a free space where the stranger can enter and become a friend instead of an enemy.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what Metanoia has been, together with the Balkan Institute for Faith and Culture. So both these entities are in close proximity. We are trying to communicate what is the foundation of both entities and why we have actually set them up. And then eventually, what we are trying to do is to present what is the deepest commitment and what is the deepest hope of our lives.
Yes.
In a way which is completely frank, transparent, true to our motives and our actions, and at the same time welcoming to all of these people. So the Balkan Institute of Faith and Culture, also being such a honest broker in society, has helped us to communicate with parts of society that usually would not talk to each other.
Yes.
But each side would basically be gladly engaged with us.
That's great to hear. Let me ask a two-part question, okay? And the first part is, what's it like in Macedonia, as far as you're concerned, when you meet a Muslim?
Again, this is the stereotype, how it works against some of the best things that the world can offer to each other. I grew up in a country in which was completely fine and common to live with people who were from different religion. That was like his historical fact as such. You know that Easter was just this past Sunday in Macedonia.
For the Orthodox, yeah.
But just a month ago or so, it was by Ramadan. It was, you know, the fasting month of the Muslims. A couple, a dear couple, he's Albanian, she's of Turkish origin. They met in Metanoia. They did meet in Metanoia. That was where they started dating with each other. They loved the place. They have a wonderful, beautiful daughter, around 2 years old. And for one of the so-called iftar dinners, you know, a dinner when they break the fast in mm-hmm. the evening, the Muslims, they invited us for dinner.
Wow.
So we went to their place. I mean, to me, that was like heaven being open in terms of how people should treat each other, how they should relate to each other. If anything, I would not go into the dogmas, into the theology. It's an important thing that we can discuss and all of that. So I don't want to be in a single way understood that I am trying to say that. I'm not. However, on the level of who we are as human beings and what God desires from us, what was happening in this encounter, I believe, was the most beautiful example of how people should live together and how we should excel, not in proving each other who is better or what, but it's how we should excel in showing the best of what we have to offer from our hearts to the others and share it freely without any hesitations, without any reservations, back and forth. It was a beautiful moment for both my wife and I.
Yeah.
We feel deeply honored. We were the first people, for that Ramadan, I mean, for this 1 month, we were the first people that they have decided to invite outside of close family to come to visit them for iftar.
Wow.
And what I could say is that one of the most important things that Macedonia and the Balkans can teach the rest of the world is to realize that living next to someone who is in a way with a worldview or a very different to you by language, by look, by even by religion, the best way to actually encounter them and fight stereotypes, fight the possibility of conflict, is to meet them.
Yes.
Invite them or accept an invitation.
Yes.
Be together, rejoice with them, cry with them, be human with them. It's one of the best things we can do. And I really, really genuinely believe if we can forget everything that I have said so far, this what I'm saying right now is basically the essence of what Nada and I, as representatives of the Balkanese of Faith and Culture and Metanoia, are all about.
Have you got time for a bit longer?
Absolutely.
Wow, well, I'll make it into two-parter then.
I will be more than glad to do that.
Because this is going to be phenomenal. And you can decide for yourself if it is indeed phenomenal. It is. In the next episode, which will be released next week at the usual time.